Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust. Empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Just days before the start of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session, we'll get a preview of possible changes to the state's gun laws.
Warning shot bill allows us to say that Marissa Alexander should have self-defense.
Also this week, we'll preview legislative proposals on expanding health care coverage to more Floridians, either with or without a big infusion of federal money. We'll also see what could happen as Florida officials struggle to bring state governments often creaky and obsolete information technology into the 21st century. And we'll wrap up this week's program with a trek into Florida's urban food deserts and what could be done to create nutritional oases and what are wastelands of fatty and sugary snack foods. I'm Tom Flanagan, and we'll continue our look ahead to the 2014 Florida legislative session on this special edition of Capitol Report. With apologies begged in advance for the term, we begin this week's Florida legislative preview with a literal bang. Over the next few weeks, Florida lawmakers are slated to take up a series of gun-related measures, from fixes to Florida's Stand Your Ground law to enhancing penalties for insurers who discriminate against gun owners. We have two reports on how these deliberations may play out. First, Sasha Cordner reports, while some bills appear to be moving quickly through the legislature, others appear to be stalled in the legislative process.
Picture a child pointing his finger in school saying, bang, bang, or a kid wearing a T-shirt that has a gun on it. Under Florida's zero-tolerance school policies, those kids could face suspension and could even be referred to the state's juvenile justice system. And the National Rifle Association's Marion Hammer called that insane.
You know, children have been suspended for having an NRA T-shirt that had a picture of a gun on it, for drawing a picture of a gun. You know, zero tolerance should not mean zero common sense.
So Hammer supports what she calls the Right to Be a Kid bill, seeking to revise those school policies. It's starting to move through the House and has its first Senate hearing Monday. She also says she supports a bill authored by Fort Walton Beach Republican Representative Matt Gaetz. It seeks to toughen the penalties for insurance companies who discriminate against gun owners.
They ask them whether or not they own firearms, and then sometimes they say, then we're not going to give you homeowners insurance or car insurance. It's pure discrimination.
There are also a couple of bills aimed at tweaking Florida's Stand Your Ground law. One NRA-backed bill is already on its way for a House floor vote, authored by Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby.
You know, when did this start making sense that we're putting people in prison for 20 years when they've not actually physically harmed anybody? They claim, you know, regardless of you know, what you want to believe, that they felt threatened and were acting in self-defense. So I think that we can give judges discretion on matters like this.
His aim is to fix the unintended consequences of Florida's 10 to 20 life law to allow people to fire a warning shot or show a gun if they feel threatened without fear of prosecution. It's inspired by Marissa Alexander, a Jacksonville woman who initially claimed Stand Your Ground after she fired a warning shot during an alleged domestic dispute with her husband. She received 20 years for aggravated assault. Meanwhile, the bill's Senate companion is running into a bit of a roadblock because it has several amendments tacked on that state attorneys, public defenders, and Florida sheriffs can't agree on. Those include a provision to get rid of aggravated assault from Florida's 10 to 20 life law, and another that seeks to further clarify when a person may lawfully use force in self-defense. The only change everyone agrees on that's also now included in the House version is to expunge the record of a person found not guilty. The measure is backed by Matt Gaetz, the chairman of the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee. That's the first panel Cumby's bill passed on the same day a measure repealing the controversial law failed. Gaetz says while some loopholes will be fixed in Cumby's bill, he likes the existing law, which is why he's opposed to another measure aimed at tweaking Stand Your Ground. So far, he hasn't agreed to put the House bill on the agenda because he says it lacks substance.
It's just sort of a feel-good bill so that politicians can stand up and say that they've done something, whereas it doesn't fundamentally alter anything in the law in a favorable way. But it's early. The Florida legislative session doesn't even officially begin until the beginning of March. So, you know, we never are so close-minded that we don't leave open the opportunity for some meaningful reform.
Gates says he's been in talks with the bill's Senate sponsor, Senate Democratic Leader Chris Smith, and Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons, the original law's main author. Their bill has so far cleared its first Senate hearing. Still, there are several contentious provisions both have agreed to iron out. And Smith says months later, they're still working on that.
The hardest part is the aggressor language. You know, what is an aggressor? How do you deal with aggressor? What exactly the definition of aggressor is? And their ability to use Stand Your Ground. And so we've had to look at court cases. We've talked to way too many lawyers. I've spent more time with the NRA than I've ever spent in my life trying to come up with a consensus on language.
Andy says he's hopeful something will get passed, not just in the Senate, but the House as well.
With each day, I think Representative Gates matures a little more and he gets a little closer to God. So hopefully throughout this session, he can, you know, find it in his heart to pass something that, if not, even if it lacks substance in his mind, it is still significant that we do something on this law. Our silence will be magnified if another person gets killed in a movie theater. It's not an excuse to shoot somebody dead at a gas station because their music is too loud. It's not an excuse to, you know, chase someone through the streets because they look suspicious.
Another bill starting to move relates to permits rather than guns themselves, authored by Tampa Republican Representative James Grant. It allows tax collectors to help the Department of Agriculture process concealed weapon permit applications to deal with an increased demand, and the department will still issue permits.
So right now, a citizen in Florida's option is to drive to one of the regional offices that may be several hours away, or mail in their application. And so we're allowing the tax collectors to charge a convenience fee and the Florida citizen or Florida resident to go pay that the convenience fee and get it processed more efficiently.
Under the bill, tax collectors can opt to help the Ag Department. In Leon County's Doris Malloy says while her office won't likely participate, she supports Grant's efforts.
Anytime that you can bring efficiency to the process, it's a good thing. You know, because the existing infrastructure is already there at many of the tax collector offices.
So far, both the House and Senate bills have passed their first committee stops. There's also a bill that would allow those to carry a concealed weapon without a permit during a mandatory evacuation. It's passed one House committee so far and is slated for its first Senate hearing Monday. There's also a bill that has had no hearings as yet that would allow school employees and officers on school property to carry a gun as long as they have permission from both the principal and superintendent. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our second report on pending firearm legislation comes to us from Rayma Thompson from member station WJCT in Jacksonville. You may recall that was the city whose warning shot case sparked a proposed change to Florida's gun statutes.
The House bill making its way through the Judiciary Committee extends the same protections granted under the state's controversial Stand Your Ground laws to those who only threaten the use of force. Under a current state law commonly known as 1020 Life, having a gun while committing certain crimes is punishable by at least 10 years. If the weapon is fired, it's 20.
I think most people currently don't understand that if you fire a warning shot at or in the direction of somebody, you have committed a felony, and that warning shot is punishable by 20 years in prison.
Rod Sullivan is a professor at Florida Coastal School of Law. He says it was the case of Marissa Alexander, who was sentenced to 20 years for firing a gun into a wall during a dispute with her husband, that garnered widespread attention to the so-called warning shot bill.
It addresses the concerns of Democrats who think that Marissa Alexander was wrongfully charged, and it also addresses the concerns of Republicans who believe that 1020 life has been applied in situations they didn't intend for it to be applied to.
It's not the first time legislators have proposed a bill like this. State Representative Neil Comby proposed a similar bill amending 1020 life in 2013, but it lacked enough support to survive. This time around, the bill seeks to amend Stand Your Ground, and it's seen growing support, even among those typically opposed to the state's self-defense laws. Alita Alston-Torrey heads the grassroots group Free Marissa Now. Alston-Torrey was on a panel of lawyers and advocates speaking out against Stand Your Ground last week, but she says she supports Comby's bill.
The warning shot bill allows us to say that Marissa Alexander should have self-defense, right? She should be looked upon as any other domestic violence survivor.
Alexander's conviction was thrown out by an appeals court, and she's scheduled for a new trial this summer. The warning shot bill has made its way past the House Criminal Justice Committee, and in January, an identical Senate bill proposed by Senator Greg Evers passed the Senate Criminal Justice Committee.
What this bill is about is addressing force with force, and is needed as that person deems that they feel comfortable with.
The issue was briefly referenced during the closely watched murder trial of Michael Dunn in the death of 17-year-old Jordan Davis. During testimony, Dunn's attorney asked him if he was aware that firing a warning shot was illegal in Florida. Dunn said that he was. Evers says a bill in place could have made a difference.
I think it's very possible that, there could have actually been two lives saved out of that situation.
But Assistant State Attorney Mark Khalil objects. The Jacksonville prosecutor says the current state laws already protect individuals seeking to protect themselves.
The law as it exists currently allows for the use of justifiable use of deadly force as a defense to brandishing a weapon.
The new bills state that explicitly by including phrases such as threatened use of force and defensive display. But Khalil says they have the potential to make a bad situation worse.
And adding language, and by calling it, for lack of a better term, I think it's inappropriate to call it this way, the warning shot bill, you are emboldening people to brandish weapons or to fire warning shots when they feel they are justified.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on its own version of the bill the first week of March.
That report from Rayma Thompson at member station WJCT in Jacksonville. Still to come on Capitol Report, last year Florida lawmakers refused to accept billions of dollars in federal Medicaid money, but could they reverse that decision this year?
We are very pleased to hear that there are sponsors to legislation to expand health care.
Lawmakers are taking up a list of bills this session to catch the state's laws up with technology.
The reason why you're seeing lawmakers starting to get involved with these types of potential laws and proposed laws is because they're now starting to get involved in social media.
And we'll learn what's being done to bring more healthy food into neighborhoods where that kind of food is hard to find.
I mean, behaviors are difficult to change in terms of food habits. But a lot of times it does come down to whether or not it's available and whether they can afford it.
Florida has stayed on the sidelines for more than a year as other states have taken the federal government up on its offer to provide more money as more people are added to the Medicaid rolls. Last year, the state House and Senate flirted with the idea of accepting the money, but ultimately failed to reach an agreement that would have made that possible. Still, the conversation continued even after lawmakers went home. Now, as Lynn Hatter tells us, recent remarks by House and Senate leaders are renewing hopes that a deal to extend health coverage to more people may come out of this year's lawmaking session.
When Tampa Bay resident Victoria Stout first heard about the Affordable Care Act, she was excited. She's 57, self-employed, healthy, and uninsured. Her odd jobs earn her an income, but it's not enough to afford private insurance. So the federal health law and the promise of subsidies to purchase insurance sounded great until she realized her income was too low to qualify for financial assistance.
Actually, I just found my 1040 from 2012. My adjusted gross income was between $10,000 and $11,000, and by the time I got my standard deduction and exemption, my taxable income was about $600.
That puts Stout right at the federal poverty level. Technically, she qualifies for Medicaid under the federal health law, except for another problem. States aren't required to expand their Medicaid rolls, and Florida is among a minority of states that have refused the federal government's offer to fund an expansion of the program. So, according to Florida's current Medicaid rolls, Stout makes too much money to qualify for the health insurance program.
If something catastrophic was to happen to me, I would be screwed. Mm-hmm. So, every day is a gamble.
She's one of nearly a million Floridians who fall into the Medicaid expansion gap. They make too much to qualify for Florida's Medicaid program for low-income people, and they make too little to qualify for insurance subsidies through the federal health insurance exchanges. Last year, Florida lawmakers turned down more than $50 billion federal dollars that could have been used to insure more people like Stout. The Florida Senate wanted to use the money to help subsidize private insurance plans for the people who otherwise would have been eligible for Medicaid. The House did not and offered a far smaller proposal. The two sides couldn't agree. Since then, most legislative leaders asked about the status of negotiations have said the same thing. Medicaid is dead for 2014. But other lawmakers, like Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia, didn't get the memo.
The next step will be to sit down and have a conversation with Speaker Weatherford and his team and see if we can come up with a compromise. It doesn't have to be this bill that we have before us. It could be we can modify the bill, but I think it's important to have a conversation.
Garcia has refiled the Senate's Medicaid expansion proposal for the upcoming session, and he's got a House sponsor in Newport Richey, Democrat Amanda Murphy. More recently, House Speaker Will Weatherford refused to declare Medicaid expansion a dead issue.
Look, nothing's ever dead for the session. I think the House has a very clear position on Medicaid expansion. I think we've talked about it for quite some time. I know where the editorial boards are. They probably know where I am on it philosophically, and I think the Senate is offered a proposal, and the House has as well, but we have not been able to negotiate a place where everyone is happy. I believe that the ball is in Secretary Sebelius's court.
That's U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius, whose agency oversees Medicaid and Medicare. Weatherford's refusal to give an out-and-out no to the Medicaid question is giving some groups, such as the healthcare advocacy agency Florida Chain, hope that lawmakers can work out a deal this year. Leah Barber-Hines is Chain's executive director.
We are very pleased to hear that there are sponsors to legislation to expand health care, and also very pleased to hear the leadership talking about this opportunity still being on the table during session.
And despite signs to the contrary, Florida's leaders never stopped trying to find a way to break the impasse between the House and Senate, even though a compromise has been elusive. Back in July, Senate President Don Gates wrote a letter to the federal government asking if the state could get approval for a partial expansion of Medicaid. In other words, a plan that would cover more people than the House proposed, but fewer than what the Senate wanted. Gates says the feds weren't interested.
Well, I can't speak for Secretary Sebelius. I don't know why she chose not to positively respond to our request. I don't know which part of our approach she found the most troublesome, but we were not able to work anything out with the federal government. Therefore, we really had no basis on which to go back and try to negotiate with the governor and the House of Representatives.
In short, the federal government has said yes to the Senate's plan, no to the House's plan, and a yes but to a compromise. If the two chambers met in the middle of their plans, the state would not be able to tap the $50 billion in federal money, but it would still be eligible for a regular Medicaid match. In the final weeks of the 2013 legislative session, a compromise plan between the two chambers was discussed, but no bill ever emerged. Still, lawmakers like Garcia say they're working to find a way forward. The Florida legislature is now in a place where it could pick up where it left off last year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
This year's legislature will discuss cyberbullying, revenge porn, and social media passwords, and creating a new technology agency. Regan McCarthy reports the bills are part of a raft of legislation aimed at aligning Florida law with recent advances in technology.
Venice Republican Senator Nancy Dietert says the computer technology legislation isn't surprising. It's a sign of the times.
I think it's probably evident to all of us that our laws have not kept up with technology, and we're going to be seeing a lot more of these type bills.
And while no one seems to question whether more such bills are on the horizon, whether Florida is behind in legislation technology depends on whom you ask. Steve DelBianco is the executive director of industry group NetChoice. He says lawmakers are reacting swiftly to the new issues created by advances in technology.
That's right. Legislators at the state level are very quick to respond to concerns they hear about, whether from constituents or from experts. And as you know, in state legislatures, an idea can become a bill in a few days, and a bill could become a law in 2 weeks. So things move quickly in 50 different state capitals, and it happens every year.
Andrew Selipak is the director of the University of Florida's new social media master's program. He points out Facebook just celebrated its 10th birthday.
If you think about who the lawmakers are, they're generally a little bit older and probably are not accustomed to what's going on in the social media world. So it's not something that's on the front of their minds because they're probably not very active and probably don't understand the pitfalls and the dangers associated with it.
And Selipak says even as lawmakers work to address issues such as cyberbullying and whether employers can request employees' Facebook passwords, technology is advancing and the state's young people are looking for new ways to communicate without being under the watchful eye of the generations before them. But DelBianco says that's one aspect of the state's proposed cyberbullying rule he likes.
It has a very high bar in that for a person to be convicted of the second-degree or first-degree misdemeanor, they have to willfully and maliciously and even repeatedly do this harassment or cyberbullying to another person. And that's appropriate to have a high bar when you have the ability to put somebody in jail. I think it's also applicable that SB 548 is tech neutral.
Meanwhile, DelBianco says his group has major concerns with a bill that would block employers from demanding their employees' social media passwords. He says the intentions behind the bill are good, but the execution needs work. For example, as the bill is written now, DelBianco says it would block employers from asking interviewees for their email addresses.
Fortunately, this is an easy fix. The legislature need only add one name. Add the word and between username and password. In other words, it should be a violation for an employer to ask you for your email and password when all they need is your email in order to reach back and communicate.
And DelBianco says the bill should have a section called Permitted Actions by an Employer that would spell out what an employer could do, like requiring an employee to hand over passwords to comply with certain investigations. But Michael Schmidt, who practices social media employment law, says a lot of those issues are already working themselves out.
The legislatures are trying to take action, have been trying to take action to avoid putting employees or potential employees in the position where they've got to make that choice. And Facebook came out fairly early on also trying to address that, I guess you can call it employer power struggle, and say, we're going to have a problem, even if it's not statutorily addressed, we're going to have a problem with employers if they are forcing people to give up their account information as well.
But DelBianco says he's glad to see lawmakers working on the issue at a state level, too. He says he'd rather not wait for federal legislation or court rulings. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week on Capitol Report, there are many places in Florida where you're miles away from fresh fruits and vegetables, but fatty, salty snack foods are literally on every corner. From member station WUSF in Tampa, Lottie Watts reports the matter of created oasis areas in these food deserts may get serious legislative consideration this year.
It takes 15 minutes on a bus for Roberta Bell to get from her home in St. Petersburg to the closest grocery store. It takes even longer to get to the downtown Publix, where she says she can buy the best produce.
Because it's fresher and it's cheaper. The Walmart fruit is just kind of blah. And they want to charge more than Publix, and Publix has the best. I'm sorry.
Bell lives in an area defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service as a food desert.
There's no single definition of a food desert, but generally people mean by the term, they mean that it's usually a low-income area and an area where there's a lot of people that may have problem accessing healthy food.
That's Michelle Verplug. She's an economist with the USDA's Economic Research Service. They map food deserts across the country. In general, the maps show areas that have a poverty rate of 20% or more, with about a third of the population living more than 1 mile from a supermarket. That's in an urban area. In rural areas, more than 10 miles from a supermarket. Democratic State Senator Dwight Bullard of Miami is sponsoring a bill this session he says will help solve the access problem in these areas.
There are large segments of the population that unfortunately do not have access to quality foods. And you see this most often, of course, in socioeconomically depressed areas.
The measure would provide income tax credits to businesses that sell nutrient-dense food. For a definition of nutrient-dense food, we went to David Himmelgreen. He's a nutritional anthropologist at the University of South Florida.
They're relatively high in vitamins and minerals, you know, the healthy nutrients relative to the total calories.
Think fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat dairy products. Himmelgreen says tax incentives for stores to sell more of these healthier products in food deserts is a good first step.
I mean, behaviors are difficult to change in terms of food habits, but a lot of times it does come down to, you know, whether or not it's available and whether they can afford it.
Stores couldn't just start selling, say, bananas to earn the tax credit. For instance, there's a requirement that nutrient-dense foods account for 20% of sales.
When you're trying to incentivize grocers to produce in a community, what you want to do is, of course, stimulate the idea among grocers that there is a viable community that's willing to spend money on nutrient-rich foods.
An area in South St. Petersburg, known as Midtown, lost its supermarket about a year ago. That Sweet Bay is where Roberta Bell used to shop for her family of four.
I'll say, now I'm going to have to go all the way to Walmart on First Avenue North, but then I have to walk two blocks across the street to get to it. And just, I have a walker.
Bell says the other smaller shops closer to her home are too expensive.
Like the little neighborhood stores and stuff, they're just ridiculous. I mean, they want like $3 for a loaf of bread. It's ridiculous.
In January, a Walmart neighborhood market opened in the former Sweet Bay location. Bell is doing more of her shopping there, where she says a loaf of bread costs about a dollar. I'm Lottie Watts in Tampa.
Regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Kordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzewski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us next week for the start of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session and nightly reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.